Dirk Pfefferberg, Miller Pfefferberg, and Stegel, Paul Stegel.
Doctor.
Those names appear on a list, Schindler's List, which saved the lives of nearly 1,100 Jews in Nazi-occupied Poland and Czechoslovakia. Hello, I'm Rachel Kahn. Welcome to The Spirit of Things on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, and online at abc.net.au/rn. Today, a bond of memory as Jewish communities around the world commemorate the Shoah on April 20th, remembering the 6 million Jews who perished at the hands of the Nazis. We hear from a remarkable young Catholic Pole, Zbigniew Nozowski, who recently visited Australia and shared the inspiring story of what Polish Catholics are doing to restore their relationship to Jews and Judaism. He certainly changed my view of Poland. But before we hear from him, the installment of a cache of papers in the State Library of New South Wales has made the news. 6 boxes of Tom Keneally's research material and the manuscript copies of his novel Schindler's Ark, which was made into the movie Schindler's List by Steven Spielberg. The key item from the papers is the list of names of Jews from Krakow whom Oskar Schindler saved by defying the Nazis. All the more interesting is that Schindler was himself a member of the Nazi Party. I spoke to Dr. Olwyn Pryke, the curator of the exhibit at the State Library of New South Wales. Olwyn, I guess a lot of people, having read Schindler's Ark, wouldn't realize how much research went into it. And this is a golden opportunity, I guess, for people to see just what goes into writing a Booker Prize-winning novel such as Schindler's Ark, which, of course, was made into the film Schindler's List. What actually did Tom Keneally contribute to the library?
Well, we acquired a manuscript collection in 1996 of Tom Keneally's research material and different stages of the drafting of the novel itself. The material didn't come directly from Tom to us. We acquired it from a private collector. As I said, the boxes were very rich in manuscript material. It includes pamphlets and photographs of Tom when he has interviewed and tracked down Schindler survivors. It also includes copies of newspaper clippings, research notes made by Tom over the course of the years that he was researching the novel. And together with the different drafts of the manuscript for the novel itself.
And of course, he came across this story when he was in Los Angeles about to buy a briefcase from a man named Leopold Pfefferberg. I think his American name was Leo Page. So would some of those interviews and photographs include his research travels with Poldek, as he was also called?
Yes, they do, absolutely. It's quite a remarkable story. As you say, Tom was searching for a briefcase and got to talking to Leopold Pfefferberg. And Pfefferberg himself survived the war as a result of Schindler's actions. And he, over the course of the years after the war, had acquired an archive of material relating to Schindler's work during the war. He was a very keen advocate for Schindler and really very determined to make sure that his story came to be known. And so when he discovered that Keneally was a popular and very successful author, he very quickly told him the story of Schindler's activities during the war, and it didn't really take Tom very long to decide that he would like to write the novel.
Well, let's talk about that story, because although it is a very well-known movie, there are a lot of people who probably don't realize that Oskar Schindler was one of the great heroes of the Holocaust, I guess you would say.
I guess I should say that his actions are certainly heroic. There is still much debate about his reasons for acting as he did, and certainly some argue that some of his activities weren't necessarily clear-cut. But certainly the fact that he saved more than 1,000 Jewish workers in his factories really stands stands as a testament to his conscience and his actions.
And these were Polish Jews who were really destined for Auschwitz or one of the other death camps, who he hired for his enamelware and munitions factory. And we know them because of the list, Schindler's List, which we're sitting in front of right now.
That's true. I should say that it's commonly understood that there is only one Schindler's List, and I think the novel and the film did much to sort of cement that view. But in actual fact, they were bureaucratic documents. They were, in effect, transit lists, and quite a number were produced between 1944 and 1945.
However, we've got this one major list. I actually have a copy of two lists, one for men and one for women, which add up to about 1,100 Jews. So this list was a compilation.
That's right, that's right. And I should say that the list the library holds is a copy of the male list, and we are actually missing one of the pages. And we believe now that the copy we hold was made actually after the war. So sometime between 45 and 1980 when it came into Keneally's possession. We're fairly certain that it came from Leopold Pfefferberg, and the list is the one, of course, that then inspired Keneally to write the novel.
Now, this list actually has typed on the top 1945. So are you saying we're not sure that it was actually typed in 1945?
Well, lists obviously were typed in April 1945, and carbon copies were made at that time. I understand that the Pfefferberg family still hold what would be called an original carbon copy, and then the copy that the State Library holds is a copy of that copy.
Right. Well, of course, I have a photocopy, not one of the old carbon copies. But it is amazing to look down the list and see that next to each name was a profession. Now, what about these professions? Were they invented or authentic?
As I understand it, they were mostly invented. It was one of the ways Schindler was able to secure his workers by demonstrating their worth for the Nazi war effort. So he invented particular skills for them, integral to the manufacture of enamelware or metalworking. He also toyed with their birth dates to make sure that they were of an age that would be most valuable to, as I said, the Nazi war effort.
And, of course, the vast majority of these people were men, which makes sense because I suppose they would be the ones who would be working in such a field. But there were 300 women, 800 men, 300 women. Was that a consistent number or did they change when the factory moved?
I'm afraid I'm not sure. There is work still going on as to tracking the names over the various Schindler's lists that have been produced during 44 and 45. I can say again that they were transit lists, and Schindler's factory was initially located in Krakow in Poland, and then moved towards the end of the war to Czechoslovakia. And that involved, of course, the movement of his workers at that time as well.
I understand, though, that at the end of the war, in 1945, when Auschwitz was liquidated, there was a kind of a rogue train full of survivors who were sick, about 100 of them. They also came into Schindler's fold.
Yes, that's true. I understand that he did take in people in need when he became aware of their need. And there certainly was a very tragic instance of a train load of prisoners sort of without anywhere to go. And the conditions were very, very cold. And I understand when they opened up the carriages to take them back to the factory that many of the people had perished due to the freezing conditions, and they needed much care afterwards.
I read that about 80 actually survived, and it was due to the work of Emily. And, of course, she's often in the background, but was such an important person in this whole project.
Yes, I would agree with you. I think her contribution is less well known and certainly deserving of some further research and exploration. And I understand she was quite instrumental in caring for this particular group of people at that time. And, of course, she was Schindler's wife.
Yes, an interesting situation because at that point, taking in very ill people would not have benefited Schindler in any way. And this is where his real altruism comes out.
I have to agree with you. I mean, they're such moving accounts, and I think he would have found it extremely difficult to justify their use to him in terms of workers in a factory.
So I guess now people here in New South Wales and Sydney will be able to see this list. How is it being presented? Because, I mean, after all, it's kind of hard to present all these pages. How are you doing it here at the library?
Well, for preservation reasons, we will display different pages over the course of the months that this display will be open. It closes in November. But we have also digitised the list, and it's available through the State Library website.
Alwyn, I guess I've been assuming that when this collection was presented to you, the list was sitting right on top. But how did you actually find it?
Well, it's a wonderful story, really. And I should say that the State Library has about 11.5 kilometres of manuscript material. We have a wealth of manuscript collection, and, you know, we aim to preserve it and make it accessible to the public. But it does mean that that sometimes the sort of the detail of some of the collections isn't widely known. So my fellow curator and I went down into our archival storage area, and we were leafing through the 6 boxes of material in this particular collection, and then we stumbled upon our copy of the list. And it was a very moving moment. I mean, it's an extremely moving document.
The lives of people destined for the death camps were turned around by this very list.
Yeah. Tom Keneally quite simply put it, he wrote that the list is life, and I think I couldn't possibly put it any better.
Alwyn, looking at this list with all the information there, each person is given a birth date, we're not sure how accurate that is, as well as an occupation. Each one of those names tells a story. There's a whole family history behind it. And I wonder about the research. There's been some talk that this really should have been in the Sydney Jewish Museum, where there's a lot of research on the Holocaust being done and there are archives there. What's your view of that?
Well, I believe the material makes sense in our collection, as Tom Keneally is such a well-known author in the New South Wales community as well as internationally. So this material reached us within his research material for the novel, which of course brought the story of Schindler to the world. So we have an obligation to preserve material like this and make it accessible for absolutely everyone. And we do welcome, you know, further research into the collections, and I'd certainly be happy to hear from anybody who has any comments or is interested in the material.
Alwyn Pryke is the curator of the exhibit at the State Library of New South Wales, featuring Schindler's List and Tom Keneally's manuscript of Schindler's Ark. You can see the 13-page list of the men by going to the State Library website, and we'll have a link to it on our website at abc.net.au/rn/spiritofthings. I happen to be in the Sydney Jewish Museum this week, so I asked the education coordinator, Avril Alba, about the placement of Schindler's List in the State Library.
Avril, how do you feel about it being installed there in the public library and not here in the Sydney Jewish Museum?
Well, obviously, you know, we feel a bit jealous, I would say, is probably the first reaction. But in all seriousness, there is something about the emplacement of an object that gives it a gravitas, if you like, or a meaning, a story, some context to understand it in. And in that way, I do feel that whether it be on loan or in some way installed at some point in this museum, it would actually tell a different story. Now, what do I mean by that? The document itself, of course, will never change. That's the nature of historical documents. That's why we rely on them. But place that document after a story of a prisoner in a camp. Place that document after the story of a survivor who is only in Australia because of the benevolence of another Schindler-like figure. And that document takes on an extremely poignant, if you like, meaning because of its emplacement. And I guess it's for those reasons that I feel like at some point I would like to see that document in this museum, because I think it will give it an added meaning and give more of a profound sense to how important a document it actually is.
It's Hebrew from the Talmud. It says, whoever saves one life saves the world entire.
I could have got more out. I could have got more. I don't know if I just... I could have got more.
Asuka, there are 1,100 people who are alive because of you. Look at them.
From the Steven Spielberg film Schindler's List, written by Tom Keneally. And of course, he won the Booker Prize for the novel, and it was controversial, being a historical novel based on a real story of the unprecedented determination of Oskar Schindler to save over 1,000 Jews under the noses of the Nazis. We'll have a closer look at the Sydney Jewish Museum's new exhibition hall and the new Mary MacKillop Museum when Radio National explores Australia's museums in May. You're with the Spirit of Things on ABC Radio National and Radio Australia. The other day, an Australian commando told me that he heard the Spirit of Things while he was serving in Afghanistan. Wow, that's humbling. Speaking of war, Poland has always seemed like a vast graveyard to me. Very unfairly, I must admit, but it's a reality that haunts Poles today. Now they're doing something about it. Actually, they have been at it for a few years now. Zbigniew Nazowski is the editor-in-chief of the Catholic monthly Wieńcz in Warsaw, Poland, and he's also the Christian co-chair of the Polish Council of Christians and Jews. He was brought to Australia recently by the Institute of Polish Affairs, and with him was a booklet he edited called The Bond of Memory, which tells the story of the recent efforts by Catholics and Jews in Poland to renew a long-lost relationship.
Zbigniew Nazowski, it's very good to be speaking to you, and particularly on your first visit to Australia. I was astonished to learn from the book Bond of Memory and also from your talk that the Catholic Church of Poland has been celebrating an annual Day of Judaism for, I think it's 11 years now. Can you tell me what it consists of?
It is a special initiative which was first started in Italy, not in Poland, so we have to be sincere about it. It is an idea that there should be a special day, a kind of celebration in the churches in a specific region, in a country, to remind the Catholics about Jewish roots of their Christian faith. I think this all follows the idea presented one time by the late Pope John Paul II, who said to the Jewish community in Mainz, whoever meets Jesus Christ meets also Judaism. And he consistently repeated, and this is something what also Benedict XVI repeats after him, in spite of some differences, that it is necessary to be aware of the Jewish roots in order to be a devout, sincere Christian. So we do in Poland organize celebrations at a nationwide level and locally. Each year, a specific town, a see of a Catholic diocese is chosen, and this town is a place of a nationwide celebration, and this nationwide celebration took place now in 11 towns all over Poland. And in other towns, there are some other smaller or bigger celebrations, and there are also pastoral materials prepared for every parish. And it's up to a parish priest whether he follows them or not. Most of them not, because, well, I have to be sincere, it must take some time before such a new idea gets to the grassroots level.
Well, I would imagine that for Poles this is particularly challenging, as there aren't that many Jews around. Can you just give me an idea of how the Jewish population changed from pre-war to post-war?
Yes, now in Poland it's possible to live your life and not meet any Jew. I may say personally that I grew up in a town which used to be 60-70% Jewish before the Second World War and before the Holocaust. But in today, there is no Jew living in this town. And I grew up not knowing anything about Jewish past of my town, because my parents came to it soon before I was born. So they were not educated people. They didn't know anything about. They were not interested in the past. So only my girlfriend, my present wife, took me to the Jewish cemetery outside of my town, and then I learned about the Jewish past of this town.
Was she herself of Jewish background?
No, not at all. She simply her father was an old member of a family which lived in this town for many years, so he knew the story. And so looking at the national level, before the Second World War, 10% of the Polish populations were Polish Jews. Most of them identified themselves as Polish citizens, so they were truly Polish Jews, not just Jews living in Poland. We had many good, but also bad examples, because in the pre-war Poland, as in the pre-war Europe, due to economic hardships and for some other reasons, anti-Semitism appeared. Now, 90% of the Polish Jews died during the Holocaust. They were killed by the German Nazis, mostly on the Polish soil. Unfortunately, we Germans decided to have their concentration camps in which the Holocaust was realized on the Polish soil. It was mainly for the fact that the Polish community, Polish Jewish community, was the biggest one in Europe. So having a plan to bring all Jews from Europe to one place and to kill them, it was technically the easiest thing to have such camps in Poland. So, and Poland was the only country in Europe in which German occupying troops made an order that anybody who would save a Jew would be punished with a death, not only of this person, but of the whole family. So it was much more difficult to save Jews in the German-occupied Poland. So as a result of it, 90% of the Polish Jews were killed in the Holocaust. In my hometown, it meant that on the 19th of August 1942, half of the town were taken by the German troops to Treblinka death camp and gassed on the next day. So it changed completely the atmosphere of the town. Only 10% of Polish Jews survived, and most of them left Poland either straight after the war or later in different moments. Some of them felt very much not at home in a new Poland, seeing empty places, empty houses, seeing such a completely changed atmosphere. And also the state of Israel emerged, so many of them left for Israel.
Mm. Well, I want to ask you about the other initiative, which I think it preceded the Day of Judaism, which was a shared Christian and Jewish rejoicing in the Torah. Can you tell me about that?
Well, this is an initiative by the Polish Council of Christians and Jews at the beginning of the 90s, when the council emerged in a new, free, democratic, post-communist Poland. We searched for an idea to express something that we as Christians and we as Jews have in common. And then somebody proposed that the Jewish feast, Simchat Torah, which is a celebration of the Torah, the Jewish Bible, it would be a great opportunity because Torah is something that Jews and Christians share together, and we could do something together. So we decided to have an annual event, and we decided that it should be held in a Catholic church. Not in the synagogue, but in the church. One of the members of the Polish Council of Christians and Jews, Father Roman Injejczyk, who now, by the way, is a chaplain to the office of the President of Poland, he invited the initiative to his parish, and it was held there for many years. Now we moved to another parish. It consists of reading of the Bible passage, then commentaries follow, a Jewish one and a Christian one. We sing psalms together, we say prayers. The most beautiful thing is when we sing together the psalms, because this is a truly common prayer. I think it's a unique phenomenon that we can say psalms together because they are part of the spiritual patrimony of both religions. And as far as I know, such an initiative as the Shoot Rejoicing in the Torah that takes place in Poland is quite unique on a world scale.
And do these celebrations ever come out of the church and onto the streets?
No, this kind of celebration is thought to take place in the church buildings. It has come out of the church in a sense that a couple of years ago we decided to have a symposium that follows the prayer. So it means that it's open. Of course, all of them are publicly open and everybody can come to it. But another kind of events are organized in the public sphere, in the public arena, not only in Warsaw, but in many other towns. It is the Polish Council of Christians and Jews which has been organizing a special march of prayer on the anniversary of the uprising in the Warsaw Ghetto. It has also been started in 1992. And following this model, in many Polish towns, there are now such marches organized. A march is a special kind of phenomenon because it takes place in the public arena. It is, a part of it is prayer always. The main task is remembrance. And an idea is to go from to march from and to visit places that are very important for the Jewish presence in this town. Sometimes these are monuments in some towns. In other towns, these are places of martyrdom. It depends on a local situation. But this phenomenon, a local march of remembrance, is something very important in many Polish towns.
How many Jews, Polish Jews, are actually involved in this? Because as you've already alluded to, the population of Jews today in Poland is quite small. So is there much interest on the Jewish side of this initiative to give it strength?
It is getting, this interest is getting bigger. The Polish Jewish community had to first rebuild itself. Yet some 15 years ago, it seemed that there would be nobody anymore to pray in the Warsaw Synagogue. But now there are youth Jewish groups in not only in Warsaw, but also in other places. So the situation is changing. And at such a stage, it was necessary for most of them, and I understand it, to concentrate mainly on their own identity, not on interfaith dialogue. But there has always been leaders of the Jewish community who were involved in Jewish Christian dialogue, such as Chief Rabbi of Poland, Michael Shudry, who is always ready to come anywhere for any kind of meeting, such as philosopher Stanisław Krajewski, who is, since the very beginning, who is the Jewish co-chairman of the Polish Council of Christians and Jews. But it is changing. There was a time in which Stanisław Krajewski or Rabbi Shudruch were the only Jewish participants in the Day of Judaism, for instance, in the Catholic Church, but now there are much more Jewish participants of such events. I think that since the new Jews, because most of them rediscovered their Jewish roots, they were not educated as Jews, they have to build their own identity first. Since they get stronger in their own identity, they are opening themselves to Jewish-Christian dialogue, because it's impossible in Poland, in today's Poland, which is so much predominantly Catholic, not to engage in any kind of relationships with Catholics.
Zbigniew Nazowski is my guest. He grew up in the town of Otwock and now lives in Warsaw, Poland, a country where Jews have lived in relative peace from the 11th century. This is The Spirit of Things on ABC Radio National. I'm Rachel Kahn. After the Holocaust wiped out 90% of the Jews in Poland, it's been up to people like Zbigniew to restore some understanding of what was lost and what can be renewed for the future. One of the initiatives has been the Day of Judaism in Poland, celebrated in churches on January 17th, which falls before the Week of Prayer for Christian Unity. It's a pretty daring move, which I wanted to explore with Zbigniew Nazowski, the Christian chair of the Polish Council of Christians and Jews.
I want to ask you about Catholic identity. In the past, there has always been a fear of a Judaizing tendency in Catholicism, mm-hmm. getting too close to Judaism. Now, you've already mentioned that John Paul II almost turned that around by saying that to become a true Christian, you would encounter Jesus as a Jew, more or less. You would encounter the Jewish tradition through Jesus. But how much of that fear of Judaizing remains alive?
Well, it is still there. I mean, this change that you have described is something relatively new. It was started at the Second Vatican Council only 45 years ago. Even less, 44 years ago. Nostra Aetate was adopted in 1965. So it goes against a tradition of many centuries in which Jews were accused of deicide. They killed Jesus Christ. That's why they were not anymore chosen people. And the most difficult thing in the world is to change human consciousness. even if it takes place in the Catholic Church, which is a hierarchical structure and in which the top body, I mean the council and the popes, define the doctrine of the Church. Even in such a situation, it is very difficult to change consciousness. So such fears, they do exist. Many people are worried whether we are not too much pro-Jewish, you know? Then we always answer that nobody was more pro-Jewish than the biggest Pole in our history, John Paul II. No other pope, I think no other person even in the history, did more to fight anti-Semitism and to open Christians to Jews and to Judaism. And this is the way we answer to such fears, which do exist.
On the Jewish side, let me pose another possible objection. I imagine that Jews would say, yes, it's very easy to love Jews now that we're mostly gone, we're dead, we're buried, and that maybe the prospect of Jews coming back to Poland would not be received so well, even by those involved in Jewish-Christian dialogue. What do you say to that?
Well, such an argument is important, and I think it's really, because it's really easier to love somebody abstractly. It's much more difficult to love anybody concretely. And so in this case, it's much easier to declare one's openness to Jews if there are very few Jews around. If there were more, it would be more problematic. I think I agree with this position. Even more, I understand that there is no full reciprocity in Jewish-Christian dialogue, because on one side we have Christians who say that in order to be good Christians they should be aware of their Jewish roots, and on that other side we have Jewish groups who do not at all need Christianity in order to identify themselves as Jews. So this reciprocity is not full, but nevertheless, I'm happy that in the Jewish world, more and more efforts have taken place in order to answer to the Church's new openness. One of the examples, one of the most important examples, was a Jewish declaration on Christians and Christianity, Debru Emet, Say the Truth, that was prepared in the year 2000. It was a direct answer to the changes in the Church. They even said, Jewish intellectuals and leaders said in this declaration, that they prepared it because the new Christian position vis-à-vis Jews and Judaism was one of the best kept secrets for many Jews. That's why they wanted to make it public and to answer to it.
What kind of opportunities are there for Polish priests to avail themselves of this new kind of thinking, both in scholarship and in theology, that's mostly developed perhaps in America first?
Well, theology is developing first of all in United States and in Germany, perhaps France. It is a new theology that is needed on both sides. By the way, it is a new Christian theology of Judaism that is needed. New kind of theological perception of Judaism by Christians, and vice versa, a new Jewish theological vision of Christianity is often needed because Jews quite often think about Christians as idolatrists because, well, we as Christians believe in one God but in three persons. Yeah, what for a Jewish ear it sounds as a kind of idolatry, where it's not for us. So this kind of theological change is also needed on the Jewish side, and it does take place. For Polish priests, the most important thing is the process of formation, education of young priests. So theological seminaries should be, and quite often are, a place where they should meet with the new doctrine of the Church on this issue. If they want to read, there is plenty of books, publications, articles published by the Catholic publications which present this issue. And now in the era of internet, everybody is able to find anything on the web. So all the opportunities are open, and we only need to use them.
Mm-hmm. And of course, including the journal which you edit.
Yes, I'm editor-in-chief of the Catholic monthly review Więź, which has a long history of engagement in Polish-Jewish and Christian-Jewish dialogue. These are two levels, because, of course, we cannot say that Polish-Jewish and Christian-Jewish dialogues are the same thing. The name of my monthly review, Więź in Polish, means a bond in English, and that's why we try to link people together, to bring people together, people of different religious denominations. We are proud that among our readers are also people who are either atheists or agnostics. And Jewish themes are important for us for many, many, many years. Więź was founded in 1958 by Mr. Tadeusz Mazowiecki, who later, after the fall of communism in 1989, became the first non-communist prime minister of Free Poland. I'm one of his successors. fifth in the line. But I have to say that Mazowiecki's article about anti-Semitism, published in 1960, yet before the Second Vatican Council, was one of the beginnings of the Polish discussion about this issue. He wrote a text with a very meaningful title, Anti-Semitism of Good, Kind People.
And was it influential in your own choice in this field?
Yes, it was, because Mazowiecki defined at that time the biggest tragedy that people who seem to be good and kind nevertheless happen to be anti-Semites, happen to accept hatred against others. He defined it as a sin in a religious sense, he condemned it in a social sense, and it was a beginning of many other publications. So we in Vienna, practically every, this is a monthly review, so practically every second issue we have something on Christian-Jewish, Polish-Jewish relationships.
Do young people show any interest in taking up this challenge to dialogue with the remnant of Jews or the reintroduced Jews after the Holocaust?
Well, it's even the easiest thing is to work with young people, because they grow up in a new democratic pluralistic society. They are not anymore under the pressure of the communist propaganda as I was. They think in a different way. They want to live in an open world. And I think it is them who see very precisely that Poland, before the Second World War and before the Holocaust, was richer having national and religious minorities. That this situation in which we as Poles were put after the Second World War, nobody asked us whether we wanted it or not, this was a result of the war and of decisions taken by the great superpowers after the war. So this decision, this situation after the Holocaust, in which one-tenth of the Polish populations died, and after the change of borders, after forced migrations of people in our territories, results in a situation of almost of a homogeneous society, both nationally and religiously. Most of the Poles are baptized Catholics. And the young people see it very clearly that we miss something in living in such a homogeneous society, that we need to develop it, especially because the most beautiful period of Polish history was so-called Jagiellonian Poland. The name comes from the name of the dynasty of the Polish kings, Jagiello, 16th, 17th, 18th century, in which Poland was very proud of its multi-religious, multi-national, multicultural society, in spite of very strong Catholic majority. We were able to combine both. And it is at that time when many Jews came to Poland, because they were expelled, for instance, from Spain, and they settled in Poland. And by the way, in Hebrew, the word Polin, the Hebrew word for Poland, means you will lie peacefully here. As far as I'm able to translate it into English, because so it also shows how important a place Poland was for many Jews.
The golden era of Poland. In the 16th century, 80% of the world's Jews lived in Poland, and it was considered the center of Jewish culture and learning. This is The Spirit of Things on Radio National, abc.net.au/rn. Zbigniew Nazowski is my guest. He's the editor-in-chief of Wieńcz, which means the bond, and that's what we're exploring here, the bond between Polish Catholics and Jews, on this week of Yom HaShoah, the commemoration of the Holocaust on April 20th. I put to Zbigniew that here in our country, the relations between Poles and Jews are not particularly well developed.
Oddly enough, I think in Australia it's harder to kindle interest in relationships between a largely Holocaust survivor community and the Poles, who inevitably are seen as the perpetrators. I remember doing a story on Jedwabne, the town where all the Jews were herded into a barn and burned in 1941. I had such a terrible, very angry responses from members of the Polish community who refused to believe that Poles could carry out such a thing. So is that perhaps why we need you here to show us a good example of what's going on in Poland, what's possible?
Well, I'm really very happy that at the invitation of the Australian Institute of Polish Affairs, I could come here and have meetings both with Polish and Jewish communities here in Australia. I think it's very important to send this message about contemporary changes in Poland to both communities. And I understand why it is more difficult here in Australia for these two ethnic groups to get together. I think it's mainly of the fact that they both have to identify themselves, to defend their identity in a multicultural society. And some people may understand that defending one's identity means being against another. Well, it's absolutely false, yeah? But anyway, some people may think this way.
Yes, and I suppose, too, both communities were compelled to escape a bitter past and perhaps don't want to be reminded of it. But in Poland, those reminders are there all the time. So I suppose Poles are more compelled to face this issue one way or the other in Poland.
Well, yeah, in Poland, the situation is very different because those Jews who live there and identify themselves as Jews are Polish Jews. My Jewish friend Stanisław Krajewski, co-chairman, Jewish co-chairman of the Polish Council of Christians and Jews, identifies himself in his book published in English as a Polish Jew. So it's not just a Jew who lives in Poland, but a Jew, a conscious Jew, who is also a Polish patriot. This is a reminder of this old Jagiellonian Poland in which Jews, Muslim, Protestants were Polish patriots in a predominantly Catholic Poland. Perhaps this might be one of the historical sources for the idea of Australian multiculturalism.
I want to ask you about those reminders because another thing that happens in Poland is the March of the Living, where young Jews from around the world come to Poland to visit Auschwitz and other sites where their ancestors, their forebears were murdered. And so I imagine that for them it is a very sad and also bitter experience. And perhaps for Poles, it's also a sad experience in that they know that these visitors are seeing Poland in almost an exclusively bad light.
Well, it is a problem, of course, and there are much discussions going also within the Jewish community and between the organizers of March of the Living and the Polish government and Polish non-governmental institutions, because some ideas cause serious problems, especially an idea that the whole March of the Living is organized in such a way that the young people travel from darkness to light. It means from death camps to flourishing Jewish life in Israel. But they come to Poland, and they are, if they are not well taught about history, they may have an impression that it is Poles who organized the Holocaust. And these were not Polish concentration camps, the places which they visit. There were German Nazi concentration camps put on the Polish soil by the German occupying troops in Poland. And it causes a problem. It's a problem. Another problematic thing is that especially Israeli youth come to Poland with their own security. So, as Poles, even Polish Jews as well, protest against it, because the idea behind such a solution is that is a suspicion that young Israeli kids can be endangered in Poland, not having their own security, which is stupidity, absolute stupidity. And I know that now there are some talks at the governmental level between Poland and Israel to have Polish security instead of Israeli one. And the most important thing was that for quite a number of years, much of the living didn't want to meet even with Polish Jews because it didn't fit to the picture. Poland was supposed to be a cemetery nice of the young Jewish participants. Now it has been changing. In the last years, different phenomena were included into March of the Living. First, Polish Catholic youth decided to join Jewish marchers, and for the main ceremony in Auschwitz-Birkenau, some Polish students come in order to march together with the Jewish ones. And the program of the march has also been changing, at least for some groups. I'm proud to say that the Australian March of the Living has discovered, yet a couple of years ago, that they should get their Jewish participants in touch, in direct touch with the Polish youth. And I'm also proud to say that quite often they come to my hometown, Otwock, near Warsaw, to meet with Polish students, to have some fun together, to have some serious work together, some renovation at the Jewish cemetery. Spend simply some time together. It's not a long time. It takes some, not more than 3 hours altogether. But it's always a big experience, and always after such a meeting we receive emails that it was a life-changing experience for many Jewish participants. And even today at the Shalom College here in Sydney, I met organizers of the March of the Living who said that even Australian Jewish participants changed their approach. Yet a couple of years ago, they were willing to leave Poland as quickly as possible. Now, they rather repeat that they would like to come back to Poland for a longer time to see it anew, not only from this angle of death camps.
Well, Zbigniew, it sounds like Jewish-Christian relations in Poland has a bright future. And thank you so much for shedding a light on it for us here in Australia.
Thank you very much. I hope the future is really brighter.
Zbigniew Nazowski is the editor-in-chief of Wieńcz, a monthly review which has spawned the Wieńcz Laboratory, a Polish Catholic think tank in Warsaw. We'll have a link to its website, but you'll have to understand Polish. Zbigniew Nazowski was hosted by the Australian Institute of Polish Affairs based in Melbourne. In Australia, the Shoah is commemorated each year at St. Mary's Cathedral in a special service organized by the New South Wales Council of Christians and Jews. The Spirit of Things website will have all the details of our guests today and their websites, including the State Library of New South Wales, where you can peruse the names on Schindler's List and see whether you recognize anybody. Don't forget, you can download this program and the previous 3 programs, or you can just listen online at abc.net.au/rn/spirit of things. The program was produced by me and Jeff Wood, with sound production by Phil McKellar. Next week, the extraordinary story of Jane and the Bhagwan. A young Australian woman fell head over heels for Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, the cult leader who laughed and joked and ridiculed established religions for all their contradictions, and then went on to found his own religion with more contradictions than you can shake an incense stick at. But her devotion landed Jane in jail. Don't miss the fascinating story of Jane and the Bhagwan next week on The Spirit of Things with me, Rachel Conn.